Hello, and welcome to the News Cycle. This is your host, Iris Harshoff. Today is October 14th and a national holiday. This holiday goes by two names, Columbus Day and Indigenous Peoples Day. Columbus Day originated as a celebration of Italian-American heritage and became an official federal holiday in 1937. Fast forward to 1990 in Davis, California. A conference was held between local tribal leaders to discuss the creation of Indigenous Peoples Day. After further meetings and organized protests, the holiday was officially celebrated in 1992 in Berkeley. Indigenous Peoples Day aims to recognize Native people as the first inhabitants of the Americas and rethink Columbus's role in history. This week, I sat down with Judge Christine Williams to discuss the problems facing Native Americans in California today. Williams is a tribal judge and the director of the Tribal Justice Project at UC Davis. And after our interview, a look into Davis's annual International Festival, which took place last weekend. Judge Williams, welcome to the News Cycle.
Thank you.
First off, can you tell me about your job and about the Tribal Justice Project at UC Davis?
So I have a couple different jobs. I'm a judge for a tribe that's local to here, the Shingle Springs Band of Miwok Indians. And that led me to UC Davis, where we started a training project for tribal court judges and tribal court personnel to expand the knowledge and capacity of tribal courts, specifically in California.
For any listeners who don't know, can you tell me about the job and function of a tribal court?
A tribal court functions a lot like other courts you might be familiar with, but they have their own jurisdiction, tribes have their own laws. They're dealing mostly with tribal members, people from their own community. And the goal really is to restore balance and promote justice.
And is it difficult to work within other jurisdictions within the state?
It can be challenging, yes. We don't have complete jurisdiction over our own territories. We don't have criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians, for example. So that really limits a lot that we can do independently, which is a diminishment of tribe sovereignty. But I think in California, certain tribes, the Shingle Springs Band of Miwok Indians being one of them, and my own tribe, which I'm a member of the Yurok tribe, and our tribe is also working to partner with the state. So we're trying to see it more as an opportunity to form strong partnerships with our local jurisdictions so that we can make sure that everyone feels safe and that the reservations are a safe and healthy place to be for everyone.
How has the state been receptive to the work you do and having to work in tandem with the tribal courts?
I think it's been a process to get to where we are now. When I first started practicing law back in 2000, ran into a lot of resistance at the bench when I was appearing as a tribal attorney on behalf of tribes. I didn't think I would necessarily see that change as much as it has in my lifetime. So I'm really encouraged by how much the state judiciary has really turned a corner. I think a lot of them are true partners. There's a tribal court, state court forum that meets on a regular basis where tribal court judges and state court judges come together. We talk about issues that we share in common. And I think everyone's really looking at each other as partners and resources and more of a unified citizenship, and that's been really encouraging. So I would have to say, started somewhat grim with a very troubled history, but now I think lots of opportunity.
What do you think brought about that change?
I know exactly what brought about that change, actually. It was a group of tribal court judges got together and sent a letter to the Supreme Court Justice of California at the time, which was Ron George, and asked to have a meeting. And from there, attitudes started to change slowly. More and more state court judges started to participate in the what's now called the forum, sort of affectionately just the forum. And from there, I think awareness started to grow, education started to grow, and outcomes for our participants improved. And that's the main thing, is if partnerships weren't working and weren't producing good benefits for everyone, they probably wouldn't continue. But as we see better outcomes, fewer Native people entering the system and staying stuck in it, then that benefits everyone. So,
how do you see those changes impacting everyday citizens within your jurisdiction?
Well, for the Native American population, it's very direct. It's lower incarceration numbers. It's lower people recommitting crimes. It's fewer Native American children being removed from their families to be raised outside of their homes. But on a larger level, a lot of it is the less any population impacts the system, the less that impacts tax dollars. So right. Being able to redirect funds away from incarceration is a huge benefit to all the citizens.
And can you tell me about Governor Newsom's announcement this summer and its impacts and implications?
It was very unexpected to me to see Governor Newsom take such an affirmative stance to actually come out, issue a public apology to the Native American population, to recognize that there were wrongs that were committed and that the state government actually had a role in committing those wrongs. And to use the term genocide over and over since then has been really powerful. It's not a positive word, obviously, but I feel like there's a lot of truth in that. Mm-hmm. And so for him to not only apologize, but then want to start healing through a truth and reconciliation commission, it starts with being honest about the history. So I think we're really on a good path. I feel like there's some skepticism in the Native community. Is it really going to be followed through? Is it just going to be talk? But I'm really confident that the governor's committed to doing it just based on the actions he's taken since then, and also the fact that he's holding open houses across the state to talk more about the truth and reconciliation, and mm-hmm. also the new Heritage Center that the Native American Heritage Commission is sponsoring through the governor's office. So I see some real steps being taken, and I'm personally very encouraged.
And what misconceptions about California Native Americans do you think are most present today, and what factors are behind those misconceptions persisting?
It's hard to say, and obviously the quickest way to get in trouble in the Native community is to speak on behalf of all Native people. So I'm only speaking on behalf of me based on my personal experiences. But I think the thing that I've personally encountered most in just in my life and my practice, my career, is the invisibility. Just having people not know at all anything about the Native American history in California, even myself in grade school, having people not believe that my tribe even existed anymore. When the education system started acknowledging Native people more, it's usually in the context of the mission system, mm-hmm. which again is not a great, you know, history for California Native people. I think that's really damaging, just not having an accurate history of California Natives. Even people who grew up in California really don't know much about the California Native community. And that we have over 100 federally recognized tribes and the largest Native population, larger than in any other state.
What changes would you like to see in the education system about California Native Americans?
I think I'd like to see the shift from it being taught as a history of a past culture, sort of trapping us in a time capsule where we can't evolve and we can't grow the way other peoples and cultures have. It often leads to modern encounters of, well, you don't look Native, you're not wearing what they wore in the book, and so you're not fitting the image I have of what Native people are. It really creates this false image for the general population of what Native people are today.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you for having me. It's been such an honor for me.
For the past 9 years, the Davis International House has organized an international festival emphasizing community and diversity. On October 6th, cultures and customs converged in Central Park in a bright array of clothing, jewelry, performances, and other attractions. Emily Chapman has the story, which was co-produced by Laya Fitzpatrick.
Vendors splayed out on the green, food trucks lined the sidewalk, and stages featured swirling colors and sounds. On Sunday, Central Park was a bustling hub of activity. The festival, lasting from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m., emphasized cultural diversity. Dancers and singers performing a variety of traditional acts performed on two stages stationed on opposite sides of the lawn. The festival provides a platform for these performers to share rich ethnic tradition.
We love the whole idea of the festival and like bringing different cultures together.
Around 30 tent-covered booths covered the lawn, offering games, and displayed items of various cultures and beliefs. The Chinese Confucius Organization was one of the many groups that decided to join the festival, led by Sally Wu.
We have tea tasting, and also the Chinese calligraphy experience.
But the festival's colorful attractions were not the only diverse aspect of the event. The international festival drew in people of all kinds of ethnic backgrounds, including Maria Godoy from Chile.
You can realize, like, how different are the culture, but also how similar are. Like, so it's very nice.
And when the festival goers got hungry, there were plenty of unique cuisines to choose from. Owner of the food truck, India Jones, Vinyl Lau, takes pride in his dishes.
Everything that is on that truck and the recipes are all original. I haven't changed anything from India.
As the shadows of Central Park trees engulfed the vendor tents, the festival came to a close, but not without memories of community connections. International House Executive Director Shelley Gilbride reflects on her favorite part of the festival.
My favorite thing about this festival is seeing and being witness to all these amazing cultures that are all here in our region and in our town, and the sharing of cultural expression and just sharing all of it.
For BlueDevilHub.com, this is Emily Chapman reporting.
The news cycle is produced by the Blue Devil Hub in collaboration with the Davis Enterprise. Iris Harshaw is the producer. James Cobalt and Dahlia Krauss are the assistant producers. And Daniel Ruiz Jimenez is the studio recording engineer. Thank you for listening. See you next week.